Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, after the slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza yesterday, where over 60 people were killed and more than 2,700 wounded, protests erupted worldwide. We talk with someone at the protests in Israel, as well as an organizer of Washington, D.C. protests. Next, while the U.S. imposes economic sanctions on Iran, the U.K. and its European partners have prepared a package of initiatives to protect the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal, after the U.S. withdrawal. The British, French, and German foreign ministers will meet with their Iranian counterpart to discuss the proposal. It's unclear when such a meeting would take place and what the initiatives include. Then, the U.S. and China are closing in on a deal that would give China's ZTE telecommunications company a reprieve from crippling sanctions in exchange for Beijing removing tariffs from billions of dollars worth of U.S. agricultural goods, especially soybeans. And then the city of Seattle is introducing a new tax on large employers, namely Amazon, Starbucks, and Boeing, that will help fund programs for the homeless and for affordable housing. Amazon's multi-billionaire founder Jeff Bezos is furious and is threatening to reconsider the company's large footprint in Seattle. And finally, what's the easiest way to get arrested for marijuana possession in New York? According to a New York Times analysis, you just have to be black or Hispanic. In fact, across the city, African Americans are arrested at 8 times the rate of whites. Hispanics are arrested at 5 times the rate of whites. And in Manhattan, the rates for African Americans increases to 15 times the arrests for whites. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But now we turn again to the issue of Palestine. The U.S. moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Thousands of Palestinians were shot. We're going to talk about the protests that have erupted worldwide in opposition to this kind of terrible massacre that we saw committed yesterday and the struggle that continues today. We are joined from Tel Aviv by Bob Schlehuber, the producer of the Sputnik radio show By Any Means Necessary with Eugene Puryear and Sean Blackman, who reports on protests from the region. And we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and a member of Code Pink, an organized protest here right in the nation's capital yesterday and today. Welcome, Bob and Ariel.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ariel Gold, I know you were one of the organizers yesterday at the demonstration in front of the White House as the reports were coming in all day long. And the reports just became more and more sickening. The numbers of people killed, the numbers of people shot or wounded. And at the same time, we had in the U.S. media all of these images of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner and Benjamin Netanyahu and his wife and others just having this great gala event. I mean, you couldn't have a more discordant set of images.
Since March 30th through yesterday, over 100 people were massacred in Gaza. These included children. These included clearly marked members of the press. It was just mortifying and disgraceful what we saw from our government, what we saw from Senate Minority Leader or Democrat Chuck Schumer, who praised President Trump for moving the embassy and, in fact, took credit himself, saying, quote, "I sponsored legislation to do this 2 decades ago, and I applaud President Trump for doing it."
That's amazing. And again, this is a massacre. There were no Israeli casualties. Bob Schlehuber, you were in Ramallah yesterday, then you were in Jerusalem. Today you're in Tel Aviv. A horrendous crime has been committed. Go ahead.
Yeah, last night around 75 protesters took to the streets late into the evening to draw attention to the massacre taking place at the Prime Minister's palace there near Paris Square in Jerusalem and marched down to the U.S. consulate until about 11 p.m. at night until the Israeli police forces dispersed the crowds. They didn't have noise permits, but those 75 people were overshadowed by the rest of the population in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv walking the streets today as if nothing had happened, no more than 50 miles to the west, as you said, a massacre taking place with 58 killed yesterday alone. It's quite shocking that such atrocities could take place so close to one's border and to one's home, and yet daily life goes on. People walking around, enjoying cafes. People resumed work today after the long holiday weekend for them there in Israel. So just a shocking scene to be a part of the clashes, and then to see the change of scenery then once you enter into Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. So quite shocking nonetheless.
Sean King, who is a columnist at The Intercept, just tweeted something that I think is very apropos of this conversation. He says here, "I just saw images of a Palestinian woman throwing a rock about 20 or 25 feet. The Israeli snipers she was aiming at were at least 150 feet away. They shot and killed her anyway. I just watched videos of unarmed, nonviolent Palestinian protesters literally just standing around, not throwing anything, not even close to that fence, when bullets from Israeli snipers just started tearing through their bodies. It literally looked like target practice. The notion that Palestinians caused this and are solely to blame is twisted and evil." You know, and one of the things that shocked me this morning, too, was this narrative in the mainstream media. I saw it on CNN, I saw it on MSNBC earlier, and when I got to the office, I saw it on Fox News. And that is that this isn't, quote unquote, the Palestinian people, that this is Hamas. It's only Hamas, and that this is some sort of terrorist action against the Israeli state, the Israeli people.
I was listening to BBC on the way to work today, and BBC had the same narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Did Hamas, this was the question, this was the question, did Hamas conscript people and force them to come to that wall? And then the reporter who's being asked these questions by the BBC anchor says, well, I'm here talking with somebody who's just had their leg blown apart. They have to be flown to Egypt for surgery. And so the guy asks him, did Hamas conscript you? And the guy says, no, we all came. We're here to protest the occupation, and we're here to protest about Jerusalem. Ariel Gold, I mean, the stunning, bizarre, sick media coverage about this, it says so much about the so-called free press in the West.
Well, this is nothing new. You know, whatever happens in Gaza, it's Hamas that gets blamed. Whenever civilians die in Gaza, Israel says they were being used as human shields. This is Hamas. This is Hamas. And in this case, this was actually not led at all by Hamas. This was an effort by Palestinian civil society in Gaza. Hamas was one of the sponsors of it, as they should be. As the ruling government there, they should support the will of the people to engage in peaceful protests. And let's also look at, you know, we're talking about just the, you know, what's taking place on the front line of the fences, but these protests also involved cultural events. They involved food and celebration, dabka dancing. This is the situation, you know, this is the will of the people in Gaza. And we have to look at the fact that what would drive civilians in Gaza to engage in a protest where they know they might be killed. And it's a situation where they're dying already. This is a desperate situation in Gaza. Palestinians there have 4 hours at most of electricity per day. 97% of the water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. Gaza has been living under an 11-year-long siege. The hospitals where the wounded and dying are being taken to can't handle the influx of patients. They don't have the medicine, the supplies, the fuel. This is a desperate situation. And people figure, I'm going to protest. Even if I die, I will die with dignity, because I'm sure living without dignity.
There's an issue here, too, at a higher level. And that is that because of the situation between the Gulf countries and Iran, those Gulf countries are de facto aligning themselves with Israel. And part of that, the quid pro quo, frankly, is that countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates are to turn their back on the Palestinians and are to work with the Israelis against Iran. So Ariel makes an important point here about water, about clean water. There is no clean water in Palestine, or at least in Gaza, and that's the plan. The plan is to just, you know, wait the Palestinian people out. They're otherwise may have been clean water because the Saudis were perfectly willing to pay for it. But that's just not going to happen anymore.
Go ahead, Bob.
And the sense of betrayal that Palestinians have felt, several have expressed towards Saudi Arabia, and just the devastation of where do you turn now to the international community? Obviously, the United States, for men, has never been a broker of peace in their eyes. But now, obviously, the Palestinian Authority refusing to meet with U.S. delegations. The U.S., even in those who have spoken for there to be a neutral broker and try to play that, is clearly not going to play that. And now, as John's saying, with Saudi Arabia openly turning their back, as well as other Gulf countries, to feel isolated on top of it. I can't tell you enough how disgusting it was to watch a woman spray her water hose off of her balcony onto the Palestinian people at the protest of the U.S. Embassy yesterday. If recognition of Jerusalem as the capital by the United States wasn't enough, if expelling those 700,000 people and now up to 2 million people from their country wasn't enough, to spray a water hose just shows the level of lack of dignity and just care of another human being. And as Ariel is saying, being in Ramallah, I mean, you see the young people celebrating, playing drums, dancing, just being people, you know, I mean, it's so dehumanizing. And talking to so many Israelis that were excited about the move because of, like Ariel saying, everyone is Hamas, everyone is a terrorist in their eyes, and to cross over the border 20 miles to the west and just see people being people and celebrating and being together with families and loved ones on the devastation and the commemorance of Nakba Day, but to see that whole other life go completely unrespected is quite stark with one own eyes.
Yeah, we're talking with Bob Schlehuber. He's a producer with Sputnik Radio Show By Any Means Necessary with Eugene Puryear and Sean Blackman. And we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Ariel Gold. Ariel is a peace activist and a member of Code Pink. Ariel, when you sort of see what we all saw, what the world could not see yesterday, I'm just wondering, what will be the impact on younger, progressive Jewish people in the United States regarding the state of Israel or the government of Israel?
Well, we're watching a growing divide between diaspora Jews, Jews that don't live in Israel, and the Israeli population and the Israeli government. And it's a growing divide because the actions of the state of Israel in alignment with the Trump administration are out of touch and, you know, really contrary to the position and values of American Jews, and especially young American Jews. One of the most uplifting things that I experienced yesterday was being present with a group of young American Jews who built an embassy of freedom outside of the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., to say that we as American Jews will lead our community to support peace and justice, freedom and equality for all people.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. That was Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and a member of Code Pink. We were also joined from Tel Aviv by Bob Schlehuber, the producer of the Sputnik Radio Show By Any Means Necessary with Eugene Puryear and Sean Blackman. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. While the United States imposes economic sanctions on Iran, the UK and its European partners have prepared a package of initiatives to protect the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal, following the U.S. withdrawal. The British, French, and German foreign ministers will meet with their Iranian counterpart to discuss this proposal. It's unclear when such a meeting will take place and what the initiatives include. We're going to talk about that. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajarey. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for joining. Is this, as they would say in American football, a Hail Mary, last minute long pass, hoping to score a touchdown against all odds? Or do you think there is a real chance that there can be some new arrangement made minus the United States?
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that it's really mind-puzzling that why U.S. will take such a stand. And then once you come to the conclusion that this is a bizarre position, when the whole of the international community and the nuclear energy institutions are all testifying that Iran is not chasing after the atomic bomb. As a matter of fact, even before this negotiation, the intelligence services in U.S. and the West testify to the fact that Iran hasn't been doing any activity towards the nuclear bomb definitely since 2012. And then this negotiation led to the agreement. The agreement is the most robust agreement. And even when you look at and listen to Mr. Trump, it's really puzzling. I mean, if you remember, he actually announced that he is going to pull out because Iran is involved in activity and has restarted or has never stopped working towards the bomb. And then the following day, he gave a warning to Iran that don't you dare start your nuclear program. So if he's saying don't start the nuclear program, then it obviously means that there is no nuclear program to be started.
You're just being logical, though, Masoud.
Yes, but I mean, some of us have to in this crazy world that this Alistair in Wonderland sort of world of President Trump. But the reality is that I think what is now. Majority of people around the world and politicians, with the exception of those in new cons in US and Israel and Saudi Arabia, are actually agreeing on the point that this is the best way to ensure that Iran is holding to its commitment and is actually holding to the fact that it wasn't really chasing that. Any sane person will come to the conclusion that Middle East is becoming extremely vital. There are ambitions by the Zionist State of Israel to actually start another war and bring further chaos and further difficulty in the region. And this time is going to be much bigger than what it's been in past. And the best way to stop this is to have a very transparent policy that will not allow people to misuse and get us into a war that could be devastating far beyond what we have seen in past. And what we saw in past is devastating enough. I mean, look at how much we all suffer because of Iraq war, how much the Iraqis suffered because of the Iraq war, how much we suffered and people in Libya are suffering, how much suffering is around the whole world because of what's happening in Syria, not just the suffering which is unleashed on ordinary citizens of Syria, but through the consequences and byproduct of that, which is immigration problems, people are becoming refugees and devastating their own lives and actually sort of putting pressure on the rest of Europe and elsewhere. I mean, nobody is winner here.
I hear you. That's the voice of Masoud Shajarei. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. Masoud, I'm looking at a media outlet called Financial Tribune. The headline, Europe will offer, quote, package of initiatives, close quote, to save the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear arms deal. And then underneath it, there's a quote from Iranian President Rouhani. And this is what he says. Iran's interest in important issues related to the JCPOA, such as selling oil, gas, and petrochemicals, as well as banking relations and investment, must be clearly determined and secured. Now, will the package of initiatives that's alluded to here for Iran, will they include Iran's ability to continue to sell oil and gas and petrochemicals and have access to international credit? Because it would seem to me that the Trump administration is saying to the European allies of the United States, if you go forward and continue to trade and carry out economic commerce or provide credit to Iran, you too will be the victims of our sanctions, and thus provides or prevent gives them an ultimatum. Anyway, can Europe do something that to offset that? Will it do something to offset that?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to call this one out because the bully is really seems and is shown that is capable of doing the most stupid and bizarre and extreme sort of things. But in same time, I think there is really not much option for Europeans and the rest of the world when you've got a president like Trump who so clearly provoking chaos. And, you know, we saw with the move of the U.S. embassy and how many people died yesterday and continue to suffer. And indeed, sort of in reality, any route to peace have been shattered in between Palestinian and Israelis. And you know, these sort of policies, they have consequences. These sort of policies does not have just consequences for the people of the region, but it's got consequences for Europe and elsewhere. Someone has to stand against the bully. And if he doesn't, you know, this bully is going to drag the whole world into chaos, economical chaos, you know, sort of trade wars and many other sort of consequences of that. I mean, the reality is that if Europe is going to stand up, not because they love Iran or they, you know, loved anyone in the region, but because of their own interests. You know, the reality is that the interests of Europeans and interests of, I would say, even Americans is not to create these conflicts, is not to go down this route, is not for them to undermine this very important deal. And so therefore, you know, they have to do it. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes you have to sort of be brave enough to stand against the bully to preserve yourself. And Europe now feels that if they go down this road of actually adhering to these bizarre policies of Trump, then there will be no end to it. And the reality is that these will create chaos in Middle East and wars, which will affect the Europeans a lot more than they would affect Americans. And they're much nearer to the region, and they actually depend much more on the oil. And indeed, they understand more than Trump does the consequences of this. I think anybody understands more than Trump the consequences of these things. And I think from that point of view, I would like to think that for the sort of preservation of any sanity in diplomacy and agreement, international agreement, we need to see this through. Europeans need to see this through. And I hope that that will happen, because really, again, the consequences, if Europeans just do a lip service, then we're going to see those chaos in any case.
Yeah, the stakes are high. That was Masoud Shajarei. We talked to him from London. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The U.S. and China are closing in on a deal that would give China's ZTE telecommunications company a reprieve from crippling sanctions in exchange for Beijing removing tariffs from billions of dollars worth of U.S. agricultural goods, especially soybeans. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome, Jude.
Nice to speak to you.
Our pleasure. Jude, this is a big political story here in the United States, and you would never know it from Donald Trump's tweets. His tweet just said that we need to do something about creating jobs in China or some such thing. Really, this is about votes in the Midwest of the United States, because the Chinese were set to impose crushing tariffs on U.S. soybeans. And soybeans are grown in the U.S. Midwest, and the U.S. Midwest voted almost as a unbroken block for Donald Trump. Is there any other reason why Donald Trump would be backpedaling on ZTE?
Not that I can see. But on the other hand, Donald Trump has been extremely unpredictable throughout his presidency so far, saying one thing one day, another the other. One big piece of speculation here in the news is that it's partly to do with the upcoming North Korea talks and wanting China on side for those. But I can't really see that that would lead to this. Obviously, it's a good thing for ZTE and for China. I'm remembering to say ZTE.
Thank you. Because in the UK, they say...
they say Zed.
Zed.
Yeah. It's obviously a good thing for ZTE and it's a good thing for China. Of course, the sanctions on the tariffs on soybeans were originally a tit for tat for other threats that Donald Trump had made. And there is still whole series of very extreme demands on the table that were put on the table to China by the delegation that went last week for as to what the US is demanding in order to drop its proposed tariffs. China has responded with a similar list of actions which are being scorn is being poured on them in the US media, I notice. They were leaked. But the US's demands are similarly ludicrous, and Martin Wolf, very senior commentator on the Financial Times, said that no country could accept the demands that the US was trying to place on China, and he is by no means a supporter of China at all. He's a very middle-of-the-road, quasi-neoliberal economist. So I think the whole thing is a little bit foggy as to where we're going on this. But it looks like Trump wants, I think Trump looks like he's backing off a bit. But I don't think this is the end of the matter. It was just the first round in a war, I think.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And I think also that this has been a learning experience for Donald Trump in that he finally realizes that everything is connected. Absolutely everything is connected. You can't just say one thing about China or North Korea and have there not be some sort of political fallout, because dominoes begin to topple, and the next thing you know, farmers in Iowa don't want to vote for you anymore. And I think it's just now, after a year and a half of his presidency, that he's coming to that realization.
Yeah, but I think there's other things going on as well. I mean, as I say, the whole of Donald Trump's foreign policy has been somewhat unpredictable, going first one way, then the other, first one, then another way, then back again. And I note the coincidence of this with the withdrawal from the Iran deal, which is causing considerable concern in the EU because of the extraterritorial impact of the sanctions that the US would seek to reimpose on Iran. And this has caused Britain, France, and Germany to all take a very strong distance from the US on cancelling the Iran deal, largely for trade reasons, although also because they don't think it's the best thing for the situation in the Middle East or for changing Iran. But leaving that aside, the trade questions are very, very important. And of course, ZTE was sanctioned for breaking breaking the sanctions on Iran. So that was sort of like an announcement by the US, this is what we could do to a company if that breaks the sanctions with Iran. And that caused a lot of concern in Europe. So it wouldn't surprise me if that also had a part of the play on this.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're joined from London in this segment by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Jude is a journalist and a commentator on China and on relations between China and the UK and China and the United States. Jude, let's talk about the company in question here, ZTE. It's a really important part of the Chinese economic infrastructure, and And if it were to go down, which seemed like likely about a week ago, because if it's barred from buying any products from the United States, it was basically telling its investors that it was about to terminate production, terminate existence, cease operations. It would have a profound impact on other Chinese enterprises. Talk about the significance of ZTE for China.
Well, ZTE is a hugely successful telecoms company, but it's absolutely reliant on US technology. It gets its chips from Qualcomm and obviously uses Android, Google's Android interface. So, and there's no replacement for these in the short term. And that's why the company would have been totally brought to a standstill if this had been carried through. And of course, it's not clear what the actual outcome is going to be yet, although Donald Trump has given us clear guidance as to what he wants, which would have affected in the first place 80,000 jobs. As you said correctly, I don't believe this is Trump's concern, but it was a concern for China. But ZTE, together with other companies like Huawei, absolutely at the cutting edge of China's attempt to develop its own high-tech companies. And for the United States to completely smash into ZTE in this way would have been a total war. There's no question. I don't mean by that physical war, but there would have been retaliation. It would not have been forgivable. Whatever kind words Xi was saying formally to Trump about the whole overall situation, the Chinese media was completely clear. Every op-ed, every editorial was completely clear that this was a declaration of war by the United States, an attack on Chinese sovereignty, an attempt to treat it like a vassal state.
Yeah, in fact, the Wall Street Journal is saying that that there is a lot more to this. This isn't just ZTE and soybeans. This is the Chinese finally reacting to these unilateral trade moves by the Trump administration. So we're talking also about steel and aluminum. We're talking about U.S. exports of both pork and ginseng. Apparently, we export most of the ginseng that we cultivate in this country to China. And there can be real economic fallout because of these actions. We've got 1 minute left. Jude, you've got the last word.
Well, yes, absolutely. Although China's exports to the U.S. are larger than the U.S.'s exports to China, no one should underestimate the impact to the U.S. economy if it stopped, if those exports to China were effectively stopped by much higher tariffs. That would have a devastating impact on the U.S., probably a greater impact than the impact would be on China.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from London by Jude Woodward. Jude is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The city of Seattle is introducing a new tax on large employers, namely Amazon, Starbucks, and Boeing, that will help fund programs for the homeless and for affordable housing. Amazon's multi-billionaire founder Jeff Bezos is furious, though, and he's threatening to reconsider the company's large footprint in Seattle. We're joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She is the editor of liberationnews.org. Jane, it's been a long time. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Jane, this bill that was finally passed into law, this tax, is actually greatly watered down from what the original idea was. So tell us how the bill changed and what it means to these big companies in Seattle.
Certainly. So the original proposal would have raised $75 million to fund services and affordable housing. The bill that finally passed yesterday through City Council will raise $48 million. What this means, if you look even at the original bill and you look at Amazon's share of it, Amazon would have paid somewhere between $20 and $30 million on the basis of the tax, which would have been less than 0.5% of their profit. for a year. I haven't crunched the numbers yet on what their share of the $48 million would be, but obviously it would be even less than that.
I'm looking at a piece in Fortune magazine. It says here that the Seattle City Council released its original draft legislation that called for companies with revenues over $20 million inside the city limits to pay 26 cents for each hour worked by a Seattle-based employee, or roughly $540 per year. This is a head tax. It was to apply over 2019 and 2020, generating $86 million a year for social programs, before then turning into a payroll tax of 0.7%. It says the annual proceeds of the tax were originally calculated at $75 million before the council revised its estimates. This isn't a tax at the level that would be, that would break a corporation. It seems to me that most corporations wouldn't even notice this tax. It's so small.
That's absolutely correct. And I think what it means is, obviously, Amazon is not afraid of losing $20 million to fund affordable housing and services for the many, many homeless people that are suffering on our streets. What they're afraid of is the precedent that that not only will the people of Seattle demand more from them, but that people all over the country and all over the world will demand more. A lot of people in Seattle have the image of Amazon and Amazon employees as being, you know, well-paid, high-tech workers. But we cannot forget the many people who work in the fulfillment centers who are suffering terribly, the drivers, who many of whom are not even technically Amazon employees at all, but work through an app. And actually, in the state of Washington, and I need to point out that here in the state of Washington, we do not have a state income tax, and our state tax system is considered to be the most regressive tax system in the country. And Bezos played a role in keeping us from getting a state income tax, mind you, that Amazon is among corporations. So they're not the number one, but they're 17th among corporations in the state of Washington whose employees are receiving, Obamacare, we call it Apple Care here, and or are on food stamps, i.e. SNAP. So in other words, people who are working for Amazon, a significant portion of them are in fact receiving public assistance because they can't make ends meet on the wages that they are earning from Amazon.
And it's not just Amazon that's complaining here. It's Starbucks as well. You know, Starbucks likes to put itself out there as the concerned corporation. This is the corporation that is fighting to keep the environment healthy. It's fighting to allow their employees to have educational opportunities and healthcare. But then they released a statement that was just stunning to me yesterday. This is according to John Kelly, who's Starbucks chief of public affairs. He says, Seattle, quote, continues to spend without reforming and fail without accountability while ignoring the plight of hundreds of children sleeping outside. If they cannot provide a warm meal and safe bed to a five-year-old, no one believes they will be able to make housing affordable or address opiate addiction. That seems a little bit dissembling to me. Or am I missing something here?
Sure. Yes, and clearly the real problem is that whether it's $48 million or $75 or $86 or even $150 million that was raised by Councilwoman Shama Sawant a while back, none of those are enough dollars to actually address the problem. And recently, the Chamber of Commerce partnered with independent researchers, the McKinsey Company, to find out what was needed to address the problem, because the Chamber of Commerce was very critical of the quote unquote failure of the city to address the problem. McKinsey came back with a report that said, actually, if we really want to solve this problem, it's going to cost about $400 million a year. And what's driving it is lack of affordable housing. Another unique or possibly unique thing about the state of Washington is there is absolutely no rent control anywhere in our state.
Mm-hmm.
It was ruled unconstitutional. So landlords can charge pretty much whatever they want. Currently, we're looking at a median price for a rental apartment, a one-bedroom rental apartment within Seattle city limits of $1,500 a month. and housing costs have gone up $800 in the past few years. So we're seeing housing prices just skyrocketing upwards. And a recent Zillow study shows that for every 10% increase in rent, an additional 523 people in Seattle end up being homeless.
Wow.
So what's really driving this is lack of affordable housing. The people, the business people, these pro-capitalist types keep harping on that the city is incompetent, that the city is wasting the money, that they just aren't handling it correctly. It's their incompetence. And then the other thing, of course, the flip side of that is they hate on the poor. They say these poor people, these homeless people are disgusting. They're, you know, they use really, really horrible, dehumanizing language. They say they're out there homeless because of poor choices in their lives, not because, you know, you literally, even if you're working, you literally cannot afford to pay the rents in Seattle. And what this means, of course, is that many people are pushed out of the city into very, very long commutes, but many more people are simply unable to survive and are living in tents on the street or in their vehicles. And there are now some 400 unauthorized tent encampments within Seattle city limits, as well as several quite large authorized encampments and tiny house villages that have been really self-organized by homeless people themselves and fought for and struggled for to make them authorized encampments. But there are some 400 unauthorized encampments, and the city's only answer to those has been sweeps, where the police come in, they post it, they give a warning date, and then after the warning date, they come in and they basically gather up everybody's belongings and throw it away.
Yeah.
They're supposed to save stuff, but it's their discretion to decide what's trash and what's not trash. And they're spending millions of dollars on these sweeps. And that is some of what the millions of dollars, and as if somehow that's going to solve the problem. The other solution that they have been following that's not been particularly helpful is the so-called rapid rehousing program, in which they get people, they offer them a service and they put them in an apartment, a market rate apartment with rent subsidy. So the person's like, yay, I'm going to live indoors. They get this apartment. But at the end, the subsidy eventually is lifted. They don't get the subsidy anymore. At which point, guess what? The same conditions apply. They still can't afford market rate. So it becomes so rapid rehousing is a revolving door. And in fact, the person is maybe even worse off now because now they have an eviction on their record or an additional eviction on their record. Now they're, you know, so it's not, rapid rehousing is not the one size fits all solution that it's been touted to be. As has been pointed out, and we'll be writing on very shortly, the research shows that if you really wanted to solve the problem, the dollar figure for that would be more like $400 million, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, depending on some factors that they outline in their research. But there needs to be housing, there needs to be rent control, there needs to be services, there needs to be a lot of different things to address the issue.
Jane, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She is the editor of liberationnews.org. Check out their work at liberationnews.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
What's the easiest way to get arrested for marijuana possession in New York? According to a New York Times analysis, you just have to be black or Hispanic. In fact, across the city, African Americans are arrested at 8 times the rate of whites. Hispanics are arrested at 5 times the rate of whites. And in Manhattan, the rates for African Americans increases to 15 times the arrest rate for whites. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeis. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Kevin, good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
Kevin, this shouts racism. Is there any other, can there be any other explanation for it?
Well, it's really, first off, it's part of a bigger problem of how we police black communities in the United States and how militarized the policing is and what law enforcement means to those communities compared to white communities, especially wealthy white communities. But it's also part of a long-term reality of drug law and marijuana laws. The marijuana laws go back to, based on racism, the fear of the African-American on smoking pot, uncontrollable, takes multiple police to hold them down. Those are the kinds of stories. And the J in marijuana was put there because of anti-Mexican views. And you can go back to Nixon's tapes, which when he was president and he was talking about the marijuana war, he talked about using the marijuana laws to enforce laws against blacks and against long hairs. And so this is a tool of control. And so marijuana has always had that kind of piece to it, and it continues to. The numbers in New York are shocking, but they're not shocking. And the reality is we have to get beyond these marijuana laws completely. It's time to end prohibition. It's time to regulate and tax marijuana for adults and put this whole era of using the marijuana laws to enforce, incarcerate people who the power structure doesn't like or who racists don't like. Trying to get this off the books and take that power away from them.
Yeah, I mean, in New York, we had, of course, there was the lawsuit about a stop and frisk. You had a situation where young black and Latino people, mostly men, but young women and girls as well, were stopped in huge numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were frisked. The police, you're essentially arrested. When you're stopped and you can't leave, you're under arrest. I mean, you're not free to go. So they don't call it arrest. They say stop and frisk. Now, that was under the pretext of looking for guns. In other words, to stop violence. About 700,000 people per year were stopped and frisked in New York City. 700,000. 90% were young black and Latino people. 90%. You know how many guns were found and confiscated as a consequence of that policy in any given year? I think the number was 12. Out of 700,000 or that up there. Of course, if you're stopping and frisking people, you're going to find other things, maybe not guns. You'll find something else, like maybe you'll find a joint or half a joint or a residue of a joint, and you can be busted for that. And as a consequence, all these young people who already have the deck stacked against them in Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx and Staten Island, they now have to go to court. And guess what? They're not going to have a lawyer. Their families are not going to have the money for a lawyer. And they're going to plead. And then they're going to have a charge, an arrest on their record. And it's going to be hard to go to, it's going to be hard to get a job. It's also going to be used against you if you try to get into college.
That's right.
So in all ways, in every way, stop and frisk, the racism of the NYPD, and marijuana, and as Kevin Zeis is saying, the war on drugs in general is really nothing other than an exercise in state repression, which must, under the circumstances of the United States and under the circumstances of New York City and the New York City Police Department, be nothing other in a foundational way to being an institution of racism. And it has a terrible, terrible effect on millions of young people.
And their communities and their families and the economy of those communities is just a downward spiral. And the marijuana, just like the stop and frisk, was used to stop African Americans, Latinos, mostly males, search them, find something they could arrest them or hold them on. The odor of marijuana is used that way. The police officer claims to smell marijuana, stops the person, finds marijuana, and then they can search that person's background. Are they on probation? Did they have a previous arrest they were put on probation for? Do they have some kind of child support payment they're behind on? All sorts of problems that can be caused. And then I think it was so vivid the way that the New York Times reporters described the courtrooms, filled with black and brown people sitting in church-like pews, waiting for their time to be called before the judge. That's the reality of the U.S. court system. They are black and brown, and so are the prisons, black and brown. This is a court system and law enforcement system used in a racist way. In fact, while this article looked at marijuana arrests,
if you go through every phase of the court system, you go to the pretrial services agency, you go to the prosecution decisions, you go to the judge decisions, the parole decisions, the post-conviction and confinement decisions, the parole, every step of the way, you will see racially unfair decisions. For some reason, blacks and brown people are treated unfairly at every stage of the process. And that's been true for years, and that's why you have to really face up to this reality of a law enforcement system, a justice system used to control black and brown populations, to keep them down, keep them economically disadvantaged, keep them educationally disadvantaged, keep their communities destroyed. And that's what's happening with this law enforcement approach. And marijuana is just kind of the tip of the iceberg, because it's a broader problem than that.
Kevin, you're an attorney. Tell me, is there any legal solution to this? Stop and frisk was deemed to be unconstitutional. Can the same argument be made for something like this?
Well, I don't know about unconstitutional arguments, but the solution needs to be ending marijuana prohibition. You know, I started my career as a political advocate when I was in law school back in 1979, 1980. And when I took an internship at Normal, the marijuana lobby, and that became a 30-year career working to end the drug war. I'm still working on it. And one of the first things I did in that job to start to understand the issue was to respond to letters from prisoners and their families. And right away, you saw the racism, you saw the hardship, you saw the impact on families and on communities. And it was quiet at the time. At the time we were doing that, this was 1980, end of the Jimmy Carter, beginning of Ronald Reagan era. We were getting death threats for discussing marijuana legalization, you know, we had like maybe less than 15% support in the public for it. And now it's over 60% support for marijuana for adults legal, over 85% support for medical marijuana. We are seeing progress being made. It's time to end this charade of the war on marijuana. You don't solve the marijuana problem with a war. You don't solve it with mass arrests or mass incarceration. We've tried that for decades, and it's not made marijuana go away. What we need to do is face up. Marijuana is here, and we have the best approach to healing is to regulating it, dealing it as a health problem when people abuse it, dealing it as a choice when people don't abuse it. Get law enforcement out of this. It just complicates the situation, makes things worse, allows that racism to percolate, which is already endemic in our law enforcement and judiciary, and take that away. Let's get this behind us. And this report from the New York Times is the reason for the Mayor Blasio and the Governor Cuomo to come out for legal marijuana. I'm very glad to see we've gone down from 50,000 arrests a year in the Bloomberg era down to under 20,000 in the current era. But we got to get down to zero. We got to regulate and tax marijuana, treat it like a commodity, not a criminal act.
Yeah, John, we talked last Thursday in our segment of criminal injustice about how in the early 1970s, we were talking about the Attica Rebellion and other prison rebellions. There were 300,000 people in prison. Now we have 2.3 million people in prison, and disproportionately impacting, destroying Black and Latino communities. And at the same time, Kevin, this was the same time that America was going through the so-called deindustrialization. Detroit, Akron, Ohio, Cleveland, former like industrial centers in the Midwest, which had large Black populations, those factories left. The corporations could make more money by paying low-wage workers overseas or in the South. And as a consequence, instead of giving people jobs, this system just sent people to prison. I mean, this is just a pretext for social control, I think.
It's $50,000 a year, typically. Every state's a little different, but $50,000 a year to keep somebody in prison. Is that the best way to advance our culture, our economy, to create a fair society? Of course not. It's very counterproductive.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other thing is that during that time period you talk about, Brian, that was also the time period of the Civil Rights Movement. That was when African Americans got the right to vote, the Fair Housing Act, the civil rights laws, education laws, hospitals were integrated, schools were supposedly integrated. All this was happening at the same time. It's not a coincidence that we saw the incarceration rate, the arrest rate, and the incarceration rate of African Americans go up when civil rights were being granted. How else could you control these people
that are getting rights.
That's right. And you know, one thing Americans don't understand too is over the last 10 years, Congress has created 500 new crimes. Now I'm talking just about at the federal level, 500 new crimes. That's things that were legal last year and are now illegal and can be punishable by prison. But we're out of time.
And maybe some of those elected leaders should actually,
yeah.
I mean, whatever.
Yeah,
indeed. You know what I'm talking about.
Well, we were joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. Kevin is the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m., on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.